You're heading south of the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan, and this is episode 59, covering the week of February 13th through February 17th, 2017. Glad to have you back on the program. Coming to you a couple of days late, I've been battling a very bad head cold and actually lost my voice for about a week. So I could finally do this thing today. It's Sunday. So hopefully next week we'll be back on our regular schedule, Saturday podcast. But we have a lot to talk about, a lot of good stuff this week. Before we do that, though, I just want a couple of reminders. Number one, if you have not subscribed to our email list, you should do that. And you just go to our homepage, abbevilleinstitute.org. At the top of the page, you can see, give us your email address, and you have to give us some other information too, but you get a free ebook out of it. Hopefully in the near future, we'll be changing that ebook, so that'll be good. But for right now, it's Kirk Sales' Emancipation Hell. You can get that for free if you just give us an email address, and you will get not only our weekly email list that has an article in it plus all the articles for that week, you'll also start getting our daily dose of Dixie, which comes out every day. And it covers either an article that we publish that day on the website or something from the archives. Also, in that daily dose of Dixie, there is a new way to donate. Of course, we do exist on your generous contributions alone, but let's say you have a hard time coming up with $50 at one shot or $100, whatever the case may be. We now have a monthly donation option in that daily dose of Dixie. So if you can give us $5 a month, that will be great. We'd love it, appreciate it. If you want to give us $10 or $20 a month or $15 a month, there's other options there too. If you could spare a little more change, that's actually less than an expensive cup of coffee at Starbucks, $5 a month. So $10 a month is even about what you'd pay for a movie ticket. So if exploring what's true and valuable in the Southern tradition and our mission is important to you, please consider giving us a donation. Eventually, we will have the opportunity for you to do a monthly donation through the website, but we just haven't set that up yet. So if you get the daily dose of Dixie, you can donate monthly as little as $5 a month, and you can help us in our mission. If everyone on our email list or in our social media would give us just $5 a month, we could run our entire operations for the year and expand our programs. So it's a great way to donate and not have to come out of pocket for a tremendous amount of money at one time. Also, please, I just mentioned social media, please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, go to our like us on our YouTube page. And all those things can be found at www.abbevilleinstitute.org, or you can search Abbeville Institute on Facebook, Twitter, or YouTube, and you can find our information. Okay, so this particular week was a really good week in terms of the material we had, we offered. It was a highly trafficked week. We had a lot of interest in one of our articles, but all the articles this week were excellent. And so we started the week, of course, February 12th being Abraham Lincoln's birthday. We started, the original design for this week was to be all about Abe, but it turned out that there was a better avenue to go, and so the first article for the week was by the great Ludwell Johnson. For those of you who don't know who Ludwell Johnson is, he was a excellent Southern historian, used to teach at William & Mary, and produced a number of great articles and essays on Southern history and also on the war. In fact, his book North Against South really is the best single-volume treatment of the war, particularly from a non-PC or, you would say, a non-nationalist position. Right, so he's very critical. I think he is, though, even-handed. He's very critical of the Lincoln administration. He is also even-handed in dealing with the South as well. But it's an excellent book, and I'd highly recommend it. But this particular piece is about Abraham Lincoln, and the title of it is In Search of the Real Abe Lincoln. And I think one thing that this piece does very well when you read it, and of course it kind of fits in the theme of the week, and that is myth-making. There is a myth of Lincoln, and I think the Lincoln myth is the most troubling myth in American history. Who is Abraham Lincoln, and what does he mean for the future of America? And of course, our president of the Abbeville Institute, Don Livingston, is currently pecking away at a manuscript on this particular topic, and I think hopefully it will be released within the next year. I believe he has somebody that wants it to publish it, and so it's the idea is that there is a Lincolnian myth, and that Lincolnian myth picked up steam, of course, after Lincoln was assassinated. And as Johnson gets into this piece, you know, not even everyone in the Republican Party liked Abraham Lincoln. He didn't get 40% of the popular vote in 1860. He only got 55% in 1864, and that's without the South voting in the election. So still 45% of the Northern population didn't want Abraham Lincoln as president. And even his own friends at the time were perplexed about this Lincoln myth that was being propagated in the 1860s and, of course, carrying forward. Now, what we see today, of course, is Lincoln has become the symbol of America. For a long time, it was George Washington, and we're going to get into that next week because Washington's birthday is on the 22nd. But for a long time, it was Washington. Now it's Lincoln. And there was a really great quote in this particular piece by an abolitionist, Wendell Phillips, who said, Lincoln was a first-rate, second-rate man. And James Byard of Delaware called him an ordinary Western man. And I think that's what people thought of Lincoln at the time. He really was just a politician. He wasn't anyone special. He wasn't Washington. If you look at Washington's career and who Washington was great because, not because he served in government, but because of who Washington was as a man. And you can't say the same thing about Abraham Lincoln at all. Lincoln was a quintessential politician. He wasn't a statesman. Even Bledsoe, Albert Taylor Bledsoe, who knew Lincoln well, they actually practiced law in the same area in Illinois, was very frank about that. No one was really ever impressed about Abraham Lincoln. But after he's assassinated, he becomes a martyr, a Christ-like figure. And I think that's where Lincoln began to turn. And of course, at the time of the war, you had people already speaking within these tones in the North. We've done articles on that as well. Even the songs that were being used, the Battle Hymn of the Republic, is this type of way, John Brown's Body and these particular hymns that are messianic. You didn't find that in the South. And Lincoln was of a different upbringing than, say, George Washington. And I think that culture mattered. And so what Johnson does very well in this piece is trying to figure out, you're sifting through all these different competing visions of Abraham Lincoln, and what we've gotten is a myth-making. Lincoln is bigger than he ever was at his own time, as his contemporaries thought. And here he sits in Washington, D.C., peering down over the reflecting pool and looking at the Washington Monument, and somehow those two men are now attached. Culturally, they're miles and miles apart. And what they actually meant to America is actually miles and miles apart. I think the only thing you could say about both is that in some way, Washington was a firm believer in the Union, but he was a believer in a Union that did not exist after Lincoln got finished with the Union. You could say Lincoln believed in the Union, but what Union? What Union would that be? I think the thing that's always happened with Lincoln is people have thought, well, if he survived, the Union Reconstruction might have been different. The Union might have been put back together the way it was before, absent slavery. The South may not have been as fearfully punished, but we don't know that. Lincoln would have had to deal with the same radical Republicans that Andrew Johnson did. And even though he had more political capital, would he have been able to navigate that shark-infested ocean any better than Johnson? I'm not so certain. Lincoln had his own detractors in the Republican Party. They didn't like him. Edwin Stanton called him a gorilla. Now, Stanton, of course, was a Democrat, but Republicans who really didn't care for him. The radical Republicans thought Lincoln was too moderate. And so this is the problem with Lincoln. And I think if we could get rid of this Lincoln myth, and all Lincoln was doing was just channeling, Joseph Story and John Marshall and Alexander Hamilton. And so really the problem comes back to Alexander Hamilton, which is why my forthcoming book is How Alexander Hamilton Screwed Up America, and that will be coming out in the fall. But I think that's what you have to go back to is Hamilton. We live in Hamilton's America with Lincoln becoming the symbol of that, the myth behind it. Hamilton can't have that. Of course, he's gotten a lot more publicity recently because of the play Hamilton. But Lincoln has become really the symbol of this new America. And as Johnson points out, even Democrats are starting to use Lincoln as their guy. In the early 20th century. So it's the Lincoln myth that becomes the largest problem that we have, and this is something we'll address more. There's actually a book review we're going to put up about this, and one of Clyde Wilson's new books, the Annals of the Stupid Party, which I reviewed for another website, but we'll run it on ours too. And it gets into this. I mean, if we could just somehow get rid of the Republican Party, perhaps that would be effective. But even the Democrats have adopted this Lincoln myth as part of their own. So Lincoln, the myth, becomes the real watershed in American history. As Johnson says, the list of controversies could be extended indefinitely. And so, as Johnson talks about, this article was actually originally published in 1987. Now you use psychohistory. You start looking at Lincoln as a man and psychoanalyzing him. How was he looking at his life? The psychobiographer is looking at Lincoln a little differently. And of course, that's going to create a new Lincoln. And so, as Johnson says, needless to say, the legendary Lincoln, the myth, has been as impervious to such lampooning as Mount Rushmore is to a pea shooter. And so, of course, Lincoln, during the Civil Rights Movement, as Johnson points out, became a much larger myth because he had the ending of slavery, and Lincoln fit into that narrative. And so this is where Lincoln is, has taken new legs, for example. But of course, as he even points out, you have people that have been highly critical of Lincoln, even in the black community. Lincoln really wasn't their guy. He didn't believe in equality of races. He was only using emancipation as a political tool. Even if he came around to believing it at the end of his, believing it was the right thing to do morally at the end of his administration, there's no conclusive evidence to that. And so this is why Lincoln is so problematic. As Johnson says at the end, to the writer, the most interesting aspect of the Lincoln puzzle is not what his real motives were, since we can never know that, but why they matter so much to so many people. Is it that the purity of Lincoln's motives is indispensable to a belief in the righteousness of the Union cause? And if so, why then is it so important to believe that the cause of the Union was righteous? Is it that Americans wish their country, which many think was wrong in its last military crusade, to have been right in this one, which marked the beginning of modern America, their America? If Lincoln was not an egalitarian and the cause of the Union not particularly righteous, if the mystic chords of memory to which Lincoln appealed in his first inaugural resound to nothing more than politics as usual, do we lose our sense of identity as a nation? Do we lose our sense of mission, the belief, Lincoln's belief, that the American way is the last best hope of mankind? And if we do, what then? What then? Perhaps that's the real puzzle, he says. So, if you lose this Lincoln myth, you use the idea that the Union should have stayed together anyways. Why is that? Why is the Union higher than anything else? Why is the Union worth 1 million men? If we lose the moral righteousness, which I think that, as we've already talked about in this podcast, is the treasury of counterfeit virtue, because most Northerners were not interested in ending slavery for any moral reason. If we lose that, then what do we have left? We have an imperial crusade to hold people against their will into a political union. We don't believe in self-determination then. We have an empire. If we lose that moral righteousness, then no one can make a case for the Union. You really can't. So I think that's where the myth comes in. There has to be the Lincoln myth. Because if there was no moral righteousness of the war, then were 1 million men necessary to keep another people who determined to leave in bondage, essentially? I mean, it's like saying the abusive husband is forcing his wife to stay with him in the marriage. For what reason? To exploit? To plunder? What's the point? So that becomes the rub. You have to have the moral side to it. If you don't have the moral side to it, the Union doesn't matter. But Lincoln has been exposed, and this is why you still have the Lincoln myth perpetuated, because Lincoln is somehow the great emancipator, the man who ended slavery. It's not true, but this is what people think. And this is why it becomes so problematic. So the myth-making on one side is Abraham Lincoln making him into something that he's really not. And this began right after his assassination. They had their Messiah. They had their Jesus, their Christ-like figure now. Whether Lincoln was even religious or not, they had it. And so they're going to exploit that. On the other side, the piece we ran on Tuesday, the attack on Robert E. Lee is an assault on American history itself by Alan Brownfield. Now, Alan Brownfield, it's the first time he's ever written for us, used to be a nationally syndicated columnist. And he's a nationalist. Worked in Washington, D.C. for a long time. But he loves Southern history, and he loves Robert E. Lee. So on the one side, you have this building up of a myth. On the other side, you have people saying that Lee is a myth and must be torn down. The real Robert E. Lee, as Elizabeth Pryor's book, Misreading the Man, or I should say Reading the Man is the title of the book. I call it Misreading the Man. We have to tear down. People say this Lee is a myth. Lincoln is real, but Lee is a myth. And so in Charlottesville, Virginia, you've had a vote by the city council there, 3-2, to take down the statue of Robert E. Lee, which probably won't happen because there's a state law against it. But and the state law reads, if such are erected, meaning monuments, it shall be unlawful for the authorities of the locality or any other person or persons to disturb or interfere with any monuments or memorials so erected. So I think they're going to have a hard time taking it down. But as Brownfield said, the attack on Robert E. Lee is in reality an attack on American history itself. It has been suggested that the Washington Monument and Jefferson Memorial are inappropriate since they celebrate men who owned slaves. Those who seek to erase our history sound a bit like the Taliban and ISIS, who are busy destroying historic structures all over the Middle East if they predate the rise of Islam. As he says, history is what it is, a mixed bag of mankind's strengths and weaknesses, of extraordinary achievements and the most horrible depredations. To judge the men and women of past eras by today's standards is to be guilty of what the Quaker theologian Elton Trueblood called the sin of the present, right? The sin of the present is presentism. We have to hold these people to our values. And I think that's what we're doing with Lincoln in so many ways. We don't like slavery. And so Lincoln was the guy that was pushing for the end of slavery through the Emancipation Proclamation, which he really wasn't. But if that's what he's doing, then because we think that's good, then Lincoln is good. Since we think slavery is bad and Lee was fighting on the side that supposedly wanted to perpetuate slavery indefinitely, then Lee is bad. As Brownfield points out, slavery's been around forever. If we're going to go against, if we're going to talk about slavery in terms that it needs to be eradicated, then we can't like really any history. We can't like the Greeks. We can't like ancient Rome. We can't even like Christianity. And I think there is something to that. And this is actually when we had our seminar, our conference last year in February on the PC attack on the South, this was something that was brought up. What people don't understand is that, and Christians, bristle at this when you say, well, the Bible contains passages that you could say are pro-slavery. No, you can't say that. But I think people are aware of this. The PC crowd is aware of this. They're attacking not just Robert E. Lee, but attacking Robert E. Lee is attacking a Christian gentleman, and they are attacking Christianity. And it will come to that eventually. There's no doubt about it. I mean, Christianity is under assault all over the place. And so you're going to elevate a guy like Lincoln, who wasn't really a Christian, and tear down a guy like Lee, who was the consummate Christian gentleman. You can't say the two aren't intertwined in some way. And so when you look at this issue of Lee versus Lincoln, this is myth-making for years. For years, we've had Lee as the quintessential Southerner. In so many ways, as I pointed out a few weeks ago, Robert E. Lee's a quintessential American hero on his birthday. He's a quintessential American hero, not just the quintessential Southerner, but the quintessential American hero. You have to remember Lee's idol, which Pryor rejects, but I think you can't say that he didn't admire him, was George Washington. Everyone in America admired George Washington, and Lee was bred of the same culture as Washington. And so that makes a difference. Lincoln was not. But what's happened is that we're going to take Lee, a man whose culture, a man whose principles were without question, and tear him down and replace him with a man like Lincoln, who you can actually say, you can question his principles, his motives, his culture. You can question all of those things. He's a guerrilla. He's a first-rate, second-rate man, an ordinary Western man. Lee, though, came from a different stock. He was a different kind of American. He was the American that embodied America before the war. Lincoln did not. And so I think that's important. So it's this idea of myth-making. We're making a myth out of Lincoln and tearing down a reality in Robert E. Lee. And the same thing you can say with our piece from Wednesday, which is Yale's Folly, and by Lee Cheek and Sean Busick. But we've had Yale College decide to rename, or Yale University decide to rename Calhoun College. Last year, that idea was rejected. This year, it's going to happen. And again, this is a byproduct of political correctness. You're tearing down Calhoun because supposedly he's this awful guy, as Samuel Flagg Bemis often wrote in his books, the defender of slavery. And he always had Calhoun just near his death with his sunken-in face from tuberculosis and his wild hair. He's the defender of slavery. And nobody ever shows the pictures of Calhoun as a young, vibrant man, a good-looking man with a good sense of humor. This idea he had no sense of humor is also a myth. But we're going to tear down Calhoun and replace it with what, Yale? Elihu Yale, the man who was a slave trader? Because Calhoun was attached to the South, he's bad, but Yale, he's a northern guy, he's okay, but Yale was trading in slaves. The entire Brown family, for whom Brown University is named after, trading in slaves. Faneuil Hall in Boston, the cradle of the American War for Independence, was financed by slavery. So where do we, do we just stop with Southerners? We start tearing down everything. But we're not going to, because you see, Yale can't be torn down. You can't rename Yale University. The history is too profound there. It's too northern. You can't go out and rename Harvard Law School or anything like that because, Harvard Law School is financed with slave money too. But you can't say that because it's Harvard. It's Massachusetts. They have the treasure of counterfeit virtue. They fought to end slavery. No matter what they did before, their sins are exonerated. But Southerners, Robert E. Lee, John C. Calhoun, no, their sins can never be exonerated. We can't just say these men were great for all the things they did. If Henry Clay and Daniel Webster could stand up at the time of Calhoun's death and deliver moving eulogies to the man, this was their primary adversary for their entire political career. And Daniel Webster can call him one of the greatest Americans that's ever lived? Daniel Webster from Massachusetts? What does that say about the man? Daniel Webster was no friend of slavery. It says that those men were greater than the men that live today. If Robert E. Lee was recognized, North and South, after the war, as a great American, the men who he tried to kill recognized him as a great American. What does it say about modern Americans who have no skin in the game? If Union veterans could recognize Robert E. Lee as a great American, and the majority of them did, there were some who didn't. There were some who kept calling him a traitor. Of course. But if the majority of Union veterans could recognize the greatness of Lee, what does that say about people nowadays? This is the man. Lee was trying to kill them, and yet they still said he was a great man. Last time I checked, a statue's not killing anybody, unless it fell on them, maybe when they're taking it down. But this is the hypersensitive political correct age in which we live. The point of political correctness is not to heal feelings. It's to change the entire culture of an area, of a region, of a people. It's to eradicate anything that might be adversarial to communism, essentially, to cultural Marxism. But this is what we're up against. So it's the propping up of one myth, the tearing down of two now. And the piece on Friday will get into another myth as well. Well, actually, let's talk about that one first, and we'll wrap up with the Thursday piece. The Friday piece was Union or Else by Karen Stokes. It's about William Tecumseh Sherman and the myth of Sherman. Even to this, I mean, I was surprised several years ago, the city of Columbia, which Sherman burned, erected a statue to William Tecumseh Sherman. Now, if that's not Stockholm Syndrome, I don't know what is. Sherman, the man who said that secession was false political doctrine, that any and every people have a right, or he actually said self-determination, that any and every people have a right to self-government. That's a false political doctrine. He called freedom of conscience, freedom of the press, nonsense and trash. And of course, then he unleashed hell throughout the South. But Sherman now has been elevated to a great American. A great American. We had the Sherman tank in World War II. Now, I could see as an implement of war, you might want a guy that has no quarter for the enemy. But still, this man should be in nowhere revered. He should be elevated to a high level, whereas Lee, a great gentleman, should be torn down. We should erect a statue to Sherman who engaged in plundering and burning and raping. And Lee, the man who showed restraint, should be torn down. If it wasn't so sad, it'd be comical. Sherman, the man who marched out west and proceeded to inflict total war on the Indian tribes. He was just bringing the methods from the east to the west. This is the lost part of Reconstruction. They were reconstructing the Indian tribes. And we'll probably do more on that on the website in the future, but this guy should have a statue, whereas Robert E. Lee cannot. It's a shame. And of course, Karen Stokes is promoting her book, A Legion of Devils, Sherman in South Carolina, which is it's the unpublished journal of James Jefferson McCarter. And he talks about Sherman's march through South Carolina. But Sherman should not be given any credit in American history as anything great. He was an awful guy. And yet Lee, the man who no one had a negative thing to say about before or after or during the war, it didn't matter if you're talking about North or South, is going to be called, you know, a racist, a bigot, and torn down because he supported self-determination of the Southern people. Again, if it wasn't so sad, you would have to laugh. If someone was to say this 50 years ago, they would laugh in your face. We're going to elevate Sherman and tear down Lee. We're going to take Calhoun College off of Yale College, one of the greatest graduates that university has ever had. We're going to take his name down because he was a Southerner, because he supported slavery. So did Elihu Yale, the entire faculty and president of Yale. They were all pro-slavery. In fact, as Larry Tise has pointed out, pro-slavery ideology found its greatest proponents in the North. That was brought to the South through theological instruction. So it's amazing. We've gotten to this point where people just really don't understand what they're doing. And finally, the piece that we ran on Thursday by Paul Yarborough, The Burning of Atlanta, it still fits into this. What he's talking about here is the Super Bowl. So this gets into sports. And how he didn't root for Atlanta because Atlanta's not a Southern team. He'd rather would have rooted for England because they were what they were. But he didn't want to root for Atlanta because Atlanta's not really a Southern city. And all the political correctness has done is ruin the South, whether it's from the Ole Miss Rebels, now the Black Bears. You can't play Dixie anymore in the South. The Falcons play in the new South City of Atlanta, which really isn't even the South anymore. Now, of course, Yarborough says he used to root for the Yankees because that's all you had, the New York Yankees. But it's amazing how we've had this complete myth-making, and it even involves sports. In fact, one of the interesting things about sports that people don't understand, most people don't realize, but, you know, baseball, for example, and he talks about baseball in this piece. Baseball was not even played in the South till after the war. You could rarely find it. It was brought down here through Reconstruction. In fact, E. Merton Coulter's book, The South During Reconstruction, talks about sport and other things and how these things were brought into the South. after the war. Most people don't realize that, but that was part of this Reconstruction. So in so many ways, Lincoln myth-making, the tearing down of Lee, the renaming of Calhoun College, the elevation of Sherman, and then sports. Sports was part of Reconstruction. This is all the process of Reconstruction. In fact, I think you can say that in any case, most of what we're experiencing now is still a byproduct of Reconstruction. All of it, whether it's political, social, or economic. We're still being recreated. And at least Barack Obama was open about that in 2009 when he assumed office. He said, we're going to continue remaking America, and he has. And that's exactly what's happening on many different levels. This is why I've said on this program, we should not really pay much attention to quote-unquote national politics, because in order to change anything, it has to change here. It has to change at the local level. We have to have people listen to this podcast and follow the Abbeville Institute and go out and follow Lou Rockwell or the 10th Amendment Center. We have to have people get out and think about their own backyard. You have to get involved in your church and your local communities. Start thinking about your home, family relationships. These things are important because that's the only way anything's going to change. This is going to be a long war. We've lost it. The war, we've already been run over. That war is already over. But how do you rebuild from that? Do you accept the invader and simply say, okay, we're just going to go along with your culture? Or do you try to, even in your own way, in your own family, just say, you know what? We're going to teach things differently here. And then your kids will teach things differently. So you can see how this would grow exponentially. It could take another 100 years for this to turn around, maybe longer. But as long as things like the Abbeville Institute exist and we keep putting material out there for you to read and digest and understand, and if you really firmly practice that and practice those beliefs and teach those things to your children and grandchildren, that's the turning point. It's not going to. There's no political solution. It won't happen. In fact, I think it's still going to get worse. So this is why we have to build from the ground up. This is why we have to have the podcasts and the articles on the website. The website is the great leveling spirit out there. It is the ultimate information system where we can get information out to people and they can find an alternate view. It changes the ball game. There's no monopoly on information anymore because of podcasting, because of internet articles, because of the amount of information that's out there and primary material even online. Things you can get that you couldn't get before. It changes everything. And so, that said, please consider a donation to the Abbeville Institute. Help us do this thing. If you believe in this enough, help us do this thing so that we can continue to explore what's true and valuable in the Southern tradition, so we can continue to produce articles like we have and material for our website and this podcast. If you believe in it, support it. Again, if you get our daily dose of Dixie, look at the bottom. You got opportunities for $5, $10, $15, $20 a month. For $5 a month, again, if everybody on that email list, if everybody on our social media gave us $5 a month, we would be smashing the other side because we would have enough money, again, not only to run what we're doing here, our current levels, current programs, we could offer more. We could do more summer schools. We could do more conferences. We could have videos. We could do more material, but we need your help. So I hope you enjoyed this particular week. Hopefully my voice will be back to 100% next week, and we'll be back on a regular schedule. But until next time, good day.